Very nice to be here among friends. I often am not. Nearly every day, in fact. And this morning's panels, I think, were a useful prelude to what I want to talk about this afternoon. And bear with me, because I think it's a topic that a lot of us maybe have not given as much thought to as we'd like. And it's what I call the media's preference for the statist. That's S-T-A-T-I-S-T, statist quote. On January 28, 1980, President Reagan completed what President Carter had started somewhat timidly. He finished deregulating the price of oil and thus ended the oil shortage. And with that single stroke of a pen, he also began the demise of the current career activity of perhaps 1,000 journalists around the country and writers, and at least 100 in Washington alone, who were then specializing in the energy beat. Within a year, the nation and the world were in a demonstrably developing oil glut. Prices were easing down, and OPEC was in such disarray that by 1986, George Bush was begging the Saudis to keep oil from falling below $10 a barrel. He got his wish. To put it bluntly, until last month, the energy news beat had all but disappeared. Now, I've cited this example for only one reason. It illustrates something that I have observed over the last 5 years since I moved from Boston to Washington. The national press is not liberal, per se, so much as it is statist. That is, committed to the promotion of an ever larger and more intrusive government presence in every aspect of our lives, except, of course, in the lives of the press. However, contrary to popular opinion, its commitment is, I don't think, nearly as much ideological as it is a matter of what Nobelist economist James Buchanan has defined for the world as public choice. The idea that politicians and bureaucrats have a totally different set of motivations than the private choice market. And the press shares those public choice incentives. Now, the press is quite rightly perceived to be the principal watchdog of government, while markets are the principal watchdog of the private economy. Any activity that moves out of the market and into the purview of government exchanges the watchdogs of the market for the watchdogs, I should say lapdogs, of the press. Indeed, government must have a watchdog precisely because it is not ruled by the disciplines of the market. Unhappily, just as government needs the press to watch and cover it, so the press needs government for its beat and its sources, its leaks, and not to mention in Washington, its circulation. Now, if you doubt this, I ask you merely to consider how exactly the rise of the National Press Corps in Washington has paralleled the rise in the power and the interventionism of the federal government. In 1936, there were only 2,355 pages of federal rules and regulations published in the Federal Register, and the Washington National Press Corps could gather en masse a few hundred strong in a modest meeting room in the Mayflower Hotel, which they did. And the total congressional staff on Capitol Hill then numbered less than 2,000. By 1968, the Register was publishing nearly 21,000 pages a year of mayhem. The congressional staff was up to more than 11,000, and the National Press Corps was up to 1,600. And then came the Great Society. And before the Reagan counter-revolution of 1981, the Federal Register in 1980 published an astonishing 87,000 pages in a single year. The congressional staff was now over 17,000, not counting the Library of Congress, the GAO, and other assorted agencies. And, not surprisingly, to cover all of this vastly increased confrontation, chaos, and general all-around corruption of power, the National Press Corps had soared to a little over 3,000. And incidentally, it didn't slow up during the Reagan years. It's now over 4,500. So instead of watchdogging and containing this massive explosion of government, the press became its biggest cheerleader. Why not? and one of its principal beneficiaries. The status quo was expanding at a geometric rate, and the press was happily aboard the Federal Express freight train. Now, we see this status tendency in microcosm in what is called the boys on the bus syndrome, and I'm going to take respectful issue with Fred Barnes. In political campaigns in which the press following a candidate tends to promote that candidate and to protect him to some degree, because he is, after all, their turtle. In June 1988, case in point, the state of Massachusetts was then collapsing into fiscal insolvency, borrowing large chunks of costly short-term money, 200 to 300 million at a crack every 4 weeks, just to pay for current payrolls. One would have thought that would have gained some attention. The fiscal and economic crisis and the obvious mismanagement behind it escalated noisily in the Boston press. In fairness, the Globe and the Herald were presenting these crazy stories every couple weeks, from March right through October. So much so, the Governor Dukakis had to spend 2 weeks in August in Massachusetts just to save his own home state. Even so, he only won it by 7 points in a state which is 12% Republican. And aside from the Wall Street Journal, the Detroit News editorial pages, and our own nationally syndicated columns, there was nearly a serious peep of this fiscal nightmare in the national press. Last spring, to bring you up to date, Standard & Poor's and Moody's lowered Massachusetts bond ratings to the lowest in the nation, just slightly ahead of junk bonds. They were headed for a $1.4 billion deficit, which is the fourth deficit in 4 years. Not only did this force a $1.3 billion tax increase, which is now, we're told, $500 million short, but the long-term bonding of $1.4 billion in short-term debt, unprecedented and probably unconstitutional, to allow the state to go on rolling over another $1.4 billion in short-term credit from Japanese banks. At Wednesday's Democratic Unity breakfast following John Silver's upset victory, the caucus was not even allowed, let alone invited, to speak. Now, this is just 2 years, steadily after he came within 7 points of becoming President of the United States. In February 1989, the caucus's campaign press secretary admitted in an article in the Boston Globe, no less, that they had deliberately decided to borrow their way through the 88 campaign and keep a lid on it, rather than cutting spending or raising taxes. They succeeded, of course, with a great deal of help from the press. Had the media reported this developing fiscal calamity, even as much as the liberal Boston Globe did, Bush might easily have won 49 states and a Republican majority in the Senate. Of course, that would have been bad, not only for ratings and circulation of the campaign, but for a Washington establishment, including the press, bent on a larger government enterprise. Sadly, most of the Washington national press beat, in my judgment, is nothing more than an extension of the campaign bus syndrome. If you are covering agencies, which you believe should not exist, you do not write that, because if you do, you will lose the beat. If you are covering, for example, the Interstate Commerce Commission for the Journal of Commerce, you do not say the obvious, namely the agency has been irrelevant for a decade and should have been abolished 8 years ago. After all, some 30 trade press and news reporters and half a dozen newsletters depend on that beat. Fred Barnes and I think, if we were honest about it, could cite just dozens of similar examples. Now, just as government's basic incentive is always to accrue power and to expand its turf, collaterally, its watchdog, the press, quickly discovers that the bigger and more powerful that government becomes, the bigger and more powerful they become. You do not bite the hand that is feeding you very often before you wind up in the press pound, which is to say, you lose the beat. Moreover, most watchdogs soon discover that the more government intervenes in any and all aspects of our lives, especially the economy, the more crises, controversy, and mayhem there are to report and analyze. When the government created the energy crisis by imposing price controls on oil and gas, thus giving OPEC the only power it really needed, the press immediately began to do the government's work. to height the size of the problem, define and expand its dimensions, obfuscate its origins, and above all, attack the private producers as the culprits of conspiracy. It surely never dawned on 99% of those who were on this energy beat that the problem was almost entirely the creation of government policy, and that the fastest way to end this crisis was to get government out of the way. Such a thought would, of course, have been institutionally suicidal. Not surprisingly, when President Reagan ended oil price controls, those on the energy beat had immediately predicted a disaster of greed, with gasoline prices headed for $3 a gallon and oil to $100 a barrel. So much so, the industry in Texas even believed them and went out and put 4,000 drilling rigs to work and began looting S&L to build new office buildings. They were happily, but sadly for all of us, incredibly, awfully wrong. Because from their own public policy perspective, they could not imagine how any important problem, especially one they had become so expert in covering, could be solved by killing government's role, and thus killing their own role as well. Now you know why these same folks are again beating the drums today for an energy policy and blaming the Reagan years for artificially low prices. I saw that in the New York Times. They're artificially low prices. God, awful artificially low prices. This explains why the two dirtiest words in the national press parlance these days are deregulation and privatization. Today, for example, polls show that even though airline accident and fatality rates have been cut by at least 50% since deregulation, and real fares have dropped by more than 30%, over 60% of the American people believe that deregulation has made the airlines less safe and more costly, and they want re-regulation. Who told them this? Similarly, while privatization is now sweeping the rest of the world, and especially Eastern Europe, it has been virtually stalled in the U.S. In the spring of 1988, a distinguished presidential commission delivered a well-documented endorsement of a whole series of privatization initiatives, from repealing the private express statutes that preserved the postal monopoly to the private conducting of prisons and so forth and so on. This report disappeared without a trace, dismissed as an ideological last bequest of a dying administration written by Reagan right-wing zealots. The chairman of that commission was a lifelong liberal Democrat named David Linowitz, brother of the famous Saul Linowitz, a media foreign policy darling. Mr. Linowitz frankly confessed to us over lunch his amazement and frustration that his message was almost totally shut out by the Washington Post, which had given other reports he had done such good exposure. I suggested to him that the Post had a fundamental public choice conflict with his message. The Post, after all, is the company paper for the nation's number one government company town. Anyone or anything that threatens government's basic role is definitely a threat to the Post's own lifeblood. After all, to privatize, to take something out of public view and concern, to return it to the non-political and therefore out of reach of the Post sector. Privatization, then, is the quintessential threat to the government's quintessential press. Not only does the Post circulation directly grow from a metropolitan area grown rich entirely as a result of an expanding federal government role in the economy of the world, but its readers in the permanent bureaucracy are also its principal news resource, leakers. You do not idly chew off the hand that is not only feeding you, but paying up to $3.50 a week to read you. This doesn't mean the Post will not slap the wrists of government workers and politicians. They will. It often does that with great gusto and great value. I have also noted, however, that the focus on those attacks is nearly always on those who happen to be anti-statists, namely those terrible Reaganites. The Post will seldom even ever undermine the committed states or the essential role of any government bureaucracy or call for its abolition or defunding. Its perspective is usually to try to get reform or get it more adequately funded. That's precisely why the Post has several occasions recommended a $140 billion tax hike. Why would they do any different? The massive expansion of the Washington government establishment has in just 3 decades created 5 of the 6 richest counties in America and has been matched by the demise of the less statist Washington Star, thus building effective monopoly power on the statist Post to confer or to deny celebrity status or power on its philosophical, that is, its agenda elements. This is why politicians, observing this process, usually move to the status quo left when they get to Washington. Unless, of course, they're from safe Republican or safe Democratic conservative districts. Former House Speaker Jim Wright was a good example. He came from a conservative, defense-minded, anti-tax district in Texas. Yet he steadily voted more and more as an extreme liberal. Thus, despite a repeatedly and noisily checkered ethical record since the early 60s, Wright grew steadily in political celebrity. When Newt Gingrich took him on a year or so ago, he couldn't even find 10 Republicans to sign his petition for an ethics investigation until after the Common Cause came out and said it was all right. When Wright first came to Congress, he routinely scored less than 30 with the left-wing ADA, Americans for Democratic Action. Since 1980, his record has been nearly 90% average. Recently, we analyzed the voting patterns of the House and Senate committee chairman from a ratings base year of 1974-75, or the first year thereafter when elected to the president. We used four of the most commonly used rating services, ADA, COPE for the AFL-CIO on the left, and the American Conservative Union and Chamber of Commerce of the U.S. on the right. Among the 27 House committee chairmen, the average move to the left from 74 to 88 was from 17 to 27%, from an ADA index of 63 to an ADA index of 80, and a COPE rating of 81 to an incredible 96%. By contrast, the House leadership cut to their pro-conservatives during Reagan years, ACU index 61%, from 23 down to 9, and their Chamber of Commerce pro-market rating by 42%, from 26 to 15. In the Senate, much the same pattern exists. Typical of the Senate was Bob Byrd, West Virginia, from 37% in the 88 rating in 1975 to 63% last year. Lloyd Benson, from 27 to 50%. Bennett Johnson, from 25 to 63%. You may worry about that one against David Duke. Sam Nunn, from 22 to 48%. Wendell Ford, from 48 to 70%. John Glenn, from 50 to 90%. Dan Inouye, from 51 to 90%. Yet in the same period, the CBS News poll showed the country moving the other way. They shifted the op structure from 25% down to 19% liberal, with conservatives holding from 33 to 35%. And, of course, at the same time, the unions were steadily losing power, going from 25% of the workforce down to 18%. Now, the statist incentive is obvious. To grow as a politician, you need national press. If you're a majority whip David Bonnier in a conservative working class neighborhood in Detroit, you run at home as a conservative, but when you get to Washington, you speak and vote the line that will get you the most favorable media exposure. In Washington, if you attack the status quo, you will either get no exposure, or what you get, you won't like. You don't believe me, ask Newt Gingrich. Yet in the last analysis, the Washington Press Corps is a surprisingly docile herd, following superficial stories, avoiding offending their own turf, and thus leaving vast areas of government action uncovered. When I first moved to Washington as a columnist in 1984, I was astonished to discover how easy it was to break stories about government waste and to scoop the Post. I could recount at least a dozen times, maybe more, when I did stories that the Post was later forced to report in more detail. Yet in all those cases, I knew that the Post and other national press types had been given these same stories before I had. Some of them were being peddled to me as a last resort. Again and again, I'd be amazed at how long I could sit on them safely for the publication. I kept worrying nothing happened. Case in point. On June 9th, 1987, Bill Black, then the leading Democratic executive at FISLIC and the Home Loan Bank Board, was scheduled to present a report to the House Banking Committee that proved conclusively that 95% of the Texas S&L failures were due to fraud and corruption. This was at the time when the House was insisting on only a $5 billion recap, coupled with mandated forbearance for Texas thrifts. Suddenly, as he was about to present this message, Chairman Ferdinand St. Germain, rest in peace, got a courier message from Speaker Wright's office, and St. Germain dismissed Black's testimony entirely. It was never given. Now, you'd have thought that the Beat reporters who were in that room, I hope they were, would have front page the story the next day. Nothing. I didn't even know the story had happened. 2 weeks later, I found out about this incident quite by accident from a Home Loan Bank board staffer. I picked up the black testimony from its press office. I was the first one to ask for it. This is weeks after the play. And broke the story on July 9th, a month later, as part of a series called SNL Sleeves Gate. The Wall Street Journal and the Post went with the story 4 days later on July 13th. And you will find mention of that story in the special prosecutor's report on page 274 on how on July 29th, following those stories, Wright tried to get Mr. White, Mr. Black, fired. In May of 1989, I appeared on a National Press Club panel on where was the press on the SNL scandal. I know what they were. They were covering the Beat, okay? And I was attacked harshly by other press panel members, including Hobart Rowan, for suggesting that Wright and Congress were the main culprits in running up this bill. That included the Washington Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News, protecting his turf, the editor of a thrift trade paper, Hobart Rowan of the Washington Post, and a Wall Street Journal reporter, whose name I forget. During that panel, Congressman Jim Leach challenged Rowan with a question. How come the Post, which had put as many as 30 full-time reporters on Iran Gate, worth all of $12 million, and the paper chase, after $12 million, but had only one reporter to that date on the SNL $100 to $300 billion debacle? Good question. No answer. Now, one reason, which was not brought up, but I have alluded to it, I'm going to get into it more later, warning the Post. The lone Post reporter, Kathleen Day, had become an unwitting agent in Charlie Keating's 3-year successful vendetta against Ed Gray, the only one trying to blow the whistle on the whole scandal. For months, Day was publishing perceptually damaging tidbits, that's all they were, about Ed Gray's alleged expense account excesses. I don't know where she got them, but they were being leaked to others, including me, by Bill Taggart, who was then on Charlie Keating's payroll for more than $500,000 a year to do, quote, public relations work. Charlie Keating said, I expect to get my money's worth, he was getting it. Those Kathleen Day reports on Ed Gray were single-handedly responsible for causing the Reagan administration to dump him and replace him with Danny Wall, the cozy Senate banking chief staff chief, with close ties to the Keating Five, plus one being the Post. Now, I might add, I was the only member of that press panel that raised any questions at all about the fundamental moral hazard and the danger of a deposit insurance system. They laughed when I suggested the bailout would fail unless it dealt with deposit insurance reform. A year later, I'm glad to say that Hobart Rowan wrote a column shortly after a series of mine explaining why this lack of reform was hurting the bailout. Now, let's face it. The permanent bureaucracy of the incumbent congressional leadership owns the Washington Press Corps, because the Press Corps needs them as much as they need each other. That's why we have drifted into 98% incumbency, and why the press, which had feasted on Reagan Bush sleaze rate years, suddenly wanted to end the ethics witch hunt when it turned against their own last year. This, it seems to me, is the ultimate confirmation of the Founding Fathers' strong concern about the dangers of a central government. Their belief that government works best at the most local level. Let's do a little logistics. At the city and town level, there are approximately 25 bureaucrats for every elected official. Now, not much press watchdogging is really needed in a situation like that, nor provided. At the state level, the number gets worse. There are about 320 bureaucrats for every elected official. More press watchdogging is required. At the federal level, the ratio is 5,900 to 1. A veritable press army could not restrain them, nor could they use all their leaks. This means that elected officials in Washington are as hopelessly the captive of the permanent bureaucracy as the individual Beat reporters and their editors. Reporters and editors who attempt to challenge those odds are automatically risking the basic resource on which they depend: information, leaks, access. Believe me, if I was not a syndicated columnist, I would have not run a lot of those stories, because when I ran them, that source dried up and I had to go to some other. And if you're on the beat and your own beat dries up, you're gone. Short of a real political revolution, there's only one answer to all this problem, and it's on the horizon, unfortunately. That is the worldwide information revolution and financial market integration, which is rapidly making national governments and legislatures obsolete, and the national press thereby less important. That is what brought the rapid spire downfall of the statist governments of Eastern Europe and the turmoil in the Soviet Union. But that breathtaking series of events left most Washington pundits far less enthusiastic than nervous. David Broder even complained there was so little Washington could do to influence this great revolution that was going on without our help. And they worried out loud at the increasing irrelevance of Washington power and influence. He's right. All this explains why the media have so eagerly seized on the environment as the last and most serious excuse for statist interference. While governments have always mismanaged economies, they are needed, we are told, to prevent the destruction of our planet. This is why, despite an almost unblemished record of environmentalists forecasting bizarre failures and scientific distortion to the point of fraud, press has been so completely willing to accept even the most outlandish scenarios of doom with unquestioning acquiescence. There's no better example of this, and it's my last, you better know, than the panic over the prospect of global warming. From the moment in June 1988, when Dr. James Hansen of NASA, whose budget depends on global warming, it's a public choice, told a receptively statist Senator Al Gore and his subcommittee that he was 99% confident that that summer's humongous drought and heat was the direct result and sign of the greenhouse warming. That turned out to be completely false. But from that moment, the issue was broadcast worldwide as we see wisdom. Over the next 2 years, Americans were treated with such a relentless barrage of this propaganda. By the spring of 1990, 70% of Americans were convinced that global warming was a real and imminent threat, and which it acted. A worldwide bureaucracy was already formed called the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, IPCC, and were writing policy prescriptions that would quite literally destroy our way of life if they were ever adopted. No wonder last two weeks before the Stockholm meeting of the IPCC, Maggie Thatcher and her growing environmental bureaucracy were shocked by a powerful one-hour documentary produced by Channel 4 Independent TV's prestigious Equinox program. We're going to show you a few minutes of that if we have time. The program is called The Greenhouse Conspiracy. It was produced by one of England's best science documentarians, Hilary Lawson. The prestigious Financial Times called it the best bit of television journalism of the week and probably the best of the year. He said Lawson set out to test the four pillars upon which global warming rests and showed that not one of them can be relied on. Britain's leading TV magazine, Lister, called it surely the science documentary of the year. It said its argument should be on every serious newspaper's front page, but it didn't wonder why they weren't. Yet the real reason the show was so good was that Lawson started out to do the documentary believing in global warming. What he found is what I found when I went out a year ago. Last February, the Washington chapter of the American Meteorological Society was presented with a one-hour iconoclastic destruction of global warming by Professor Patrick Michaels, who is the most articulate critic of the whole catastrophic scenario. I was the only journalist present, I expected him to be bombarded by questions, tough questions, from a hostile audience. Instead, he was enthusiastically received by the largest audience they'd ever had. As the only journalist there, I asked those at my table how they felt about Michael's story. Their response was, hey, that's mainstream understanding. Mainstream understanding. That, in fact, is exactly what I found, which led to the story that appeared on the cover of Forbes last December. I found, basically, that most climatologists think the GW scenario is vastly overstated. The New York Times was forced, 2 days after the Forbes piece appeared last December, to come out and admit the same thing. What the Times suddenly discovered, and And what they began to discover is what Science editor, the Science magazine, that's the establishment publication, Phil Abelson said last March 30th, on this issue, there has been a lot more hype than solid facts. The editorial accompanied a 10-year NASA satellite study which showed that there had been no trend in the 1980s during the period when we supposedly discovered global warming, there had been no warming trend. Now, again, this shouldn't have been surprising. A year before, there had been a story that appeared briefly on CNN, which reported a U.S. analysis of the last 100 years with no warming trend. I could go on and name a number of other stories that have been ignored. For example, last March, the USDA published a safe cropping map. That's a map that shows you where you can put your plants and crops safely. And guess what? Over the last 20 years, all the safe cropping areas have moved south, not north. Last February, one of the lead scholars for NOAA went to the AAAS meeting and reported that over the southeast, temperatures have fallen in the last 50 years. And it goes on and on. Unfortunately, as with nearly every environmental boondoggle, political, not scientific consensus is all that counts. So that when the IPCC met in Stockholm last August and actually lowered its prediction of global warming by half, that story was simply not reported anywhere. Now, we may well ask, why has the U.S. press been so completely taken in on this issue? Why, through the end of 1989, had the top national publications on Nexus cited only two experts, the two pro-global warming experts, Hansen and Schneider? 90% of the quotes came from those two. All the rest of the dissidents picked up the other 10%, and there were a dozen of those. Now, what we're talking about comes back to public choice. Global warming, if it were real, and if we had to act in the way IPCC thinks we should act, would generate the greatest growth in government power and intervention of anything we have ever conceived. If you doubt this is the goal, consider the keynote speaker picked by Al Gore to address his own April Congress. Brazil's Secretary of the Environment, José Antonio Lutzenberg, who told an enthusiastic audience that, quote, "the worst and most dangerous aspect of our modern economic thinking is the dogma of the necessity for continuous economic growth. Even the idea of sustainable growth," he said, "is a contradiction in terms." He said, "the developed countries are really overdeveloped or misdeveloped, and that since it's impossible for us to extend our way of life to other countries, third world countries, quote, there is something basically wrong with that way of life." The enthusiastic applause he received in the ballroom of the JW Marriott in Washington from a mixed press and bureaucracy audience should wake us all up to an agenda that the statist press would enormously benefit from. The central thrust of that agenda today is to reverse the quantum information revolution for a very good reason. That revolution is destroying the national press. A number of years ago, I guess it's 5 or 10 years ago, the networks had, 90% of the audience for their news shows. Now they have, 60% and going down. They know full well that the birth of the personal computer, the rise of the quantum economy, information revolution, central power, and central statism are on the way out. Just as the networks are falling apart from the competition of non-network and local media, the national press corps is rapidly degenerating into a dinosaur, still looking to revive the once great society to preserve the status quo. Fortunately, there are signs, like last Tuesday in Massachusetts, that the public is beginning to understand the government, as we have known it the last 50 years, in its institutional heyday, is a relic and a millstone. We have seen the status quo, and we know it doesn't work. But don't expect the national press to admit this and rush to cover its own demise. Thank you.